A headline last week in the New York Times reads, Panama celebrates expanded canal's successful first passage. And the reporter tells us a Chinese-owned container ship on Sunday became the first commercial vessel to successfully cross the Panama Canal's new expanded locks, a historic achievement that Panama hopes will keep the canal as relevant in this century as it was in the last. Much of the ship's transit was televised live to the nation and the world. Once the container ship successfully entered the first lock in mostly sunny, calm conditions, its passage was halted for speeches, sermons, and exchanges of memorabilia. Panamanians who went to watch the maiden passage cheered and bands played. That report, dated June 26, 2016, by Walter Bogdanich in the New York Times. Interestingly, there are historical connections to the Panama Canal from here in our region, and those connections are linked to two colorful political figures whom we meet among an array of other individuals in a recent study titled Pennsylvania Histories, 200 Years of Personalities and Events, 1750 to 1950, by Dr. Sheldon Spear, issued by Lehigh University Press. Dr. Spear was professor of history at Luzerne County Community College for over 30 years. He is professor emeritus. He has a BA in political science from Brooklyn College, a master's degree in history from Syracuse, and he received his doctorate in history from NYU. Among his books are chapters in Wyoming Valley History, Notable Men, Women, and Events, Wyoming Valley History Revisited, with a few glimpses beyond, from utopian visions to post-anthracite realities. He is co-author of The Jews of Wilkes-Barre, 150 Years, 1845 to 1995 in the Wyoming Valley of Pennsylvania, and Daniel J. Flood, a biography, The Congressional Career of an Economic Savior and Cold War Nationalist. Dr. Spear paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us about some of the fascinating figures he profiles in his newest study, Pennsylvania Histories, and we began with the title. It is not Pennsylvania History singular, but Pennsylvania Histories.
That's the word in many languages for history and story. The words are the same. Like in French, histoire means not only history, but it means story. Historia in Spanish, story. Geschichte in German, story as well as history, right? So that's what history is. It's a story, and you have to try to get some meaning out of the story. That's what history is all about.
Is that what drew you to history as a discipline?
I don't know what drew me. My father was very interested in it, and, you know, from the age of 6 or 7, I was taking history books out of the elementary school library. You know, they were written for children, of course. One was called The Story of Wheat, The Story of Corn, The Story of Rice, things like that. But I love them, you know, and I didn't have the courage to major in it in college for the reason that I didn't see myself as ever being able to stand up in front of a class and lecture and or talk about history. I was a very shy kid. You know, when I gave a speech in high school, I was terrified for a week before I had to give the speech. So I figured that's not for me. So what will I do? I'll major in political science because then I can get a government job. Thank God I didn't, right? But that was one of the things. And then I said, well, maybe not. I finally figured, what am I running away from? You know, I this is my love. It's been my love since the age of 6. And that's why I decided to go ahead and major in it.
What was the impetus for Pennsylvania Histories?
You probably know that for years I wrote about local northeastern Pennsylvania history, and I usually wrote about what I wanted to write about, and it went everywhere, all over the map, so to speak. And I decided I'll do that on the state level. Why not? I don't think there's ever been anything done like that on the state level, not that I've seen anyway. So I decided to do it that way. It was a struggle sometimes to come up with things that I thought would be interesting or for which there'd be enough information.
You wanted to make it so that there would be a balance and a range of topics.
And also a geographical range. So I dealt with not only northeastern Pennsylvania, which is now my home, but also with Philadelphia and Pittsburgh and northwestern Pennsylvania, about which I don't think the general public around here knows a great deal. It's kind of an isolated area, but something very important took place there. in the 19th century, the great oil frontier, petroleum frontier, and also the development of the city of Erie, which was important in the War of 1812 because of the Battle of Lake Erie, but also because it was a very important industrial center in its own right, too.
Now, you'd give us the opening chapter.
Bidlack. Benjamin A. Bidlack.
There's not lots about him in the record. Introduce us to him. What kinds of
things? He was a typical small-town, ambitious individual in the early 19th century. He became a lawyer, and he founded one of the first newspapers in the Pocono area. And then he got elected to Congress as a Democrat, and President Polk, another Democrat, decided, he's a pretty good guy. He's been good in the House for us, so let me give him an appointment to some small, insignificant South American country, like New Granada, as they called it at that time, which is today Colombia. And he went down there, and he worked out a treaty with them, which later served as the basis, even though it was a distortion, for American control of the Panama Canal, since Panama was originally part of Colombia. And we essentially went down there and helped the Panamanian rebels steal it from Colombia. And then we decided to make a good treaty with Panama, and we built the canal.
And there are threads throughout these stories, because we can look at Dan Flood and remember his ties to the Panama Canal.
He was a fanatic when it came to the Panama Canal, and I know this, as you remember, because you interviewed me over that book. I think he devoted almost as much time to the Panama Canal. He went through his papers as he did to almost anything else, including trying to improve the local economy. But he was so obsessed with that issue, and I'm not sure I know the total reason for it, but he was.
What's one of your hunches?
Well, it was partially a family thing, because his grandfather was a personal friend of President Theodore Roosevelt, who was so instrumental in getting that treaty through with Panama. That's one thing, but I think Dan was a great nationalist, and to give up something that we had, and which was very important at that time. It's been upgraded in recent years so that the bigger ships can now get through. So those are the reasons, I think. And he had this anti-communist streak in him that was as wide as an airplane runway. And, you know, he was fearful that the communists were waiting to take over, that the Soviet Union had planned it since the beginning of the Soviet Union to take over Panama. Which is nonsense, but that's the way a lot of people thought at that time.
There are other threads, and you just mentioned one with Bidlack, and that was newspapers. There are various instances in these stories where newspapers bubble up, including an early woman journalist.
Jane Grey Swisshelm is her name, and she was a tremendous character for her time. You have to understand what the situation was with respect to relationships between the genders. And women definitely were not privileged in any respect, not even close to it. And she became one of the first female journalists in the United States, even though she was really fighting all this time against a terrible marriage that she got herself involved in when she was still a teenager. And she went through a divorce. But she stuck up for her own career, and she managed to have custody of her daughter, which was not usual at that time. The men usually got, if there was a divorce, it was always considered to be the fault of the woman, and the man got custody. But she was able to buck all of that.
And she was Pittsburgh-born.
She was born in Pittsburgh and grew up in that area and in one of the suburbs, Wilkinsburg. Yeah, that's where she lived most of her life. But she also spent some time in Washington, D.C., as a correspondent for the New York Tribune, which was edited by Horace Greeley. And she had a column that appeared in many papers, because papers at that time borrowed each other's columnists. If you read the newspapers in Wilkes-Barre in the early 19th century, a lot of the writers were stolen, not stolen. This was the way it was done. They couldn't maintain large staffs because they didn't have the money or the resources for it. So she had a broad audience, so to speak.
And it's a name we really don't know.
No, very few people know the name. The name is interesting in and of itself, because she was what's called a collateral descendant of a woman who was very, very briefly, I think for about 14 days, Queen of England in the middle of the 16th century, Jane Grey, until she was arrested by her cousin, Mary Tudor, and she was beheaded for treason. She was only a teenager, too, in that late adolescence.
Beheading reminds me, and sadly, that you, in the events section, bring our attention to hangings
Well, they were all done legally, contrary to the lynchings. No, there was quite a bit of it. That's how people were disposed of, and mostly people who didn't have the resources to hire good lawyers or who were not fondly thought of by the general population, like immigrants from Eastern and Southern Europe. There's a case that took place in Tunkhannock involving two Jewish peddlers who murdered another Jewish peddler, and that was a tremendous excitement in that area. And I think partially because they were, you know, they were just anti-Semitic and they were looking forward to seeing two Jews hanged. Well, that was a form of entertainment. People didn't have TV to look at. They didn't have big sporting events at that day, so hangings were a big thing. Even though they weren't supposed to be public, they became semi-public, as I call it. And there were a lot of them until finally it got so out of hand the state and the county moved in and made it take place behind closed doors. In fact, that was the time the electric chair was instituted in Center County. Not that that's much better, probably, if at all, but at least it was done in private.
We may think about Gettysburg and the Civil War, but you tell us a story about Chambersburg.
Yeah, Chambersburg had a lot of bad luck in the war. Of course, it's right on the line. It's right near Virginia and what became West Virginia. Maryland isn't very far away. And it's not far from the Shenandoah Valley, which was a big storage area for the Confederate forces. And Confederates went there to make raids, but also to get to Gettysburg. A big Confederate army came in through Chambersburg. But the event that I deal with was the burning of Chambersburg in 1864 as an act of retaliation, really, for what some Union general had done in the Shenandoah Valley, of setting fire to some homes of prominent Confederate leaders or to Washington and Lee University. It was still Washington University, but it was named after General Lee later. And they were told, the inhabitants, either you come up with a lot of money in a short amount of time or we're going to burn your town down. And they couldn't come up with the money because the bankers had left, had fled, taking the money with them. And there was a stronger Union cavalry force on the outskirts coming in, and they said, we got to burn this right away. And they torched it, really. There were no deaths from it, but still it was the destruction was tremendous and people were terribly upset by what happened. And it served as a kind of inspiration for Union forces later when they moved through Georgia or South Carolina. They often yelled, "Remember Chambersburg." And it just shows that the Civil War was the first modern war in many ways, including in how much civilian destruction there was. If you look at photographs of a place like Richmond or some of the areas in the borderlands between Missouri and Kansas, you see destruction that could be from World War II, almost. So that's where I brought that in.
And we get a sense of the questions of race throughout the book. Now there's a story about a painter who's intriguing.
Henry Ossawa Tanner was his name. Ossawa, his father liked the abolitionist Brown, who was a crazy man, really, but the father looked at him as a hero, so he gave his son the middle name. Ossawa Tommy was where Mr. Brown murdered a bunch of pro-slavery people. He was raised in Philadelphia, and he became very interested in the arts, especially in painting, and he went to the Fine Arts Academy and was trained there. But he couldn't seem to get anywhere in Pennsylvania, partially because he was black, probably mainly because he was black, and he moved to Atlanta. And he became a photographer. Atlanta had a very large and slightly prosperous black population at that time. And he lived there, and he had some good friends, white friends, who helped him out and sent him to study in Europe, and he ended up in Paris. He was supposed to go to Rome, but as soon as he landed in Paris, he says, "I'm never leaving." He loved it, and it seemed to love him. It's amazing to me how much tolerance there was in Paris compared to in the United States at that time. And he just had a great time there. He eventually was recognized by the French government, given a variety of awards, and he married a white American woman. He couldn't have gotten away with that at the time in the States, probably. And he had a very good life there until the First World War came along, and he got very depressed by that because it was so horrific. And then his wife died a little later. It was a very good marriage. But he lived long enough to enjoy a lot of the fruits of his work. He had an interesting style. It was sort of half traditional, half modern, and it evolved over time. And a lot of his work dealt with religious subjects. because his father was a minister. I think he probably got most of that from him.
That French connection is also in the book. You take us up along the Susquehanna to the days of Marie Antoinette.
Asylum, which is a combination English-French word for asylum. That's what it means. Well, they're a group of émigrés who came to this country to get away from the French Revolution in the early 1790s. And some wealthy Americans who had a patch of land up there said, we can settle you there if you want. And they had this idea that they got from Rousseau and from other writers of the time that it was a marvelous thing to live in the middle of the boondocks, you know, in the middle of the woods. And you get rid of all the nonsense accoutrements of civilized life and so on. And you become better people. And so a group of them went up there, and then they found out what it was like. Especially they were aristocrats, and they were used to all the comforts that there were in the 18th century, and they found that there weren't many. I visited there twice. It's right on the river, on the Susquehanna, and it's just loaded with insects. You know, you can't walk around there in the summer without being eaten alive. So it was at least that bad probably 200 years ago. It didn't last very long, but it's an interesting little phase in Pennsylvania history. There were Englishmen who came, too, to other places in northeastern or central Pennsylvania, like Joseph Priestley, who was a great, great chemist and a Unitarian theologian, and Thomas Cooper. I wrote a chapter about him, who had a very interesting life. He ended up finally in South Carolina. And although he had been a terrible opponent of slavery in his youth, he became a great supporter of it in his last years in South Carolina. Whatever he thought, he went to the extreme. That's why I say a radical for all seasons. That's the name of the chapter.
Another thing that is so prominent in Pennsylvania history, of course, is something that we see on the cover of your book.
That's the best photo that I have, I think. This is a steel mill facility that made steel, and these are the homes of the working people, the steel workers, who had it terrible. You know, we talk in northeastern Pennsylvania about the coal mine. Well, they did. You know, I can't deny that. But their lives were just as bad and just as subject to fatalities, fatal injuries, as the anthracite miners' lives.
So we have figures like Terence Powerly and the Knights of Labor, and you spend some time with him, and so many of the figures are known outside of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, he was a Pennsylvanian. He was born in Carbondale, of Irish Catholic background, and he later became mayor of Scranton on a minor party ticket and served, I think, a total of 4 years. And he did a lot of good in that time, but his great fame comes from the fact that he was head of the Knights of Labor, which was the first really large and general kind of labor union in this country. It rose to fame in the late 1880s, but just as fast as it had risen, it fell because of some incidents for which the Knights were not responsible, but they were blamed for it. A Haymarket riot in Chicago, in which some policemen were killed. It was probably done by anarchists, not the Knights of Labor, but reading public read these newspapers which were against the Knights, and they blamed them, and this was the end of basically the end of that union.
Newspapers again. Yeah,
the newspapers were mostly prejudiced against labor, anything that had to do with helping ordinary people probably in those days.
We've just touched some of the highlights of the stories and the people in the book. Tell us what your hopes are for a book like this in terms of where we are today. What would you love if somebody picked up this book to have them take away?
Well, I hope they would have a deepened knowledge of the history of their state. That's what I'm hoping for, because many don't. Or just about American history, because that's what it really is. It's not just really local or state history. Much of it could be talked about with respect to other states, other parts of the country as well. So that's what I'm hoping for. That's what I write about, why I do it.
Dr. Sheldon Speer, Professor Emeritus of History at Luzerne County Community College, author of a number of books, including Daniel J. Flood, A Biography, The Congressional Career of an Economic Savior and Cold War Nationalist, and most recently, Pennsylvania Histories, 200 Years of Personalities and Events, 1750 to 1950, recently issued by Lehigh University Press. That's Dr. Sheldon Speer, S-P-E-A-R, And his most recent book, Pennsylvania Histories, plural, Pennsylvania Histories, 200 Years of Personalities and Events, 1750 to 1950, recently issued by Lehigh University Press. Pennsylvania Histories has an appendix, as we're told in the introduction, titled The Origins of Pennsylvania Place Names. And Dr. Speer explains this is simply an attempt to add to the public's knowledge about an interesting topic, if not an earth-shattering one. Place names often offer clues concerning a locality's origins. For example, the concentration of towns with Welsh names in the Philadelphia area, the oldest settled part of the state, correctly indicates that Welsh Quakers were part of William Penn's earliest colonization efforts. And Aaronsburg, a small town in Center County, named after Aaron Levy in 1786, is probably an indication of at least a small Jewish presence on the Pennsylvania frontier. That we learn from the introduction to Pennsylvania Histories, 200 Years of Personalities and Events, 1750 to 1950, by Dr. Sheldon Speer.